Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
Hello, this is Pete. I am one of the content producers here at Ethical Property Partners. As well as a podcast, we have our YouTube channel, and one thing that's been working brilliantly over there are our Sophisticated Saturdays. Now, this episode includes audio from a Sophisticated Saturday show where you'll hear about a deal that Frank has recently done. In the first part, you'll get all the numbers, so if you want to take part and work out how you'd do the deal, you can grab a calculator and make some notes before listening to the second part, where Frank will tell you exactly how he structured the deal in a sophisticated way. The third and final part is exclusive to you as a podcast listener, where Frank gets grilled by an expert investor and chats about the deal in more detail. So over to Frank.
In this episode, I'm going to outline a vendor who I went to meet a few years ago now, their situation, the property situation, and then I'm going to pause and you're going to have the opportunity to solve the solution, try and come up with a win-win that would work for them and work for us. And then I'm going to tell you how we've actually gone ahead and monetized the property. So this property was a commercial building. It had been a kitchen showroom on the ground floor, quite large. It was a really big building, actually. And then it had office space above. It had been a kitchen showroom and a bit of an ironmonger's kind of a property. We had delivered a leaflet to the property and the vendor called us. Quite an unusual situation. She was actually terminally ill, but she had a death in service insurance policy. And the insurance policy paid out a multiple of her income. The problem was the business hadn't traded for several years and the building was owned by her business. So the business had no cash whatsoever, couldn't pay her a salary. She had been given 3 to 4 months to live. And if she passed away with no salary having been paid, the insurance policy wouldn't pay anything out. So what she needed to do was to sell the property really quickly, get some money into the company, and then pay herself a salary, and then the insurance policy would pay out a multiple of that salary. I think it's 4 or 5 times the salary. So she just wanted some money really quickly. And the commercial agent that she was listed with, it was just stagnated on the market, wasn't doing anything at all. When she got our leaflet and it said, we can buy in just a few short weeks, she gave us a call and we went over. I went over to see her, sat down. That was quite hard help visit. Her husband did most of the talking because she was in a wheelchair. She'd lost a lot of her mobility. She couldn't talk particularly well, but she was completely there. She was completely switched on mentally. So it was quite a slow help visit. Her children were there as well, her adult children, because obviously it was a bit of an estate planning meeting as well. And they actually said, time is of the essence. We would like to wrap this up tonight. We'd gone there at about 6 o'clock. We finished talking to them about 7:30. And they said, we'd like to make a decision tonight. Could you give us some privacy? And I said, yes, how long would you like? They said, maybe an hour. So I actually went and grabbed some food. And then we went back about 8:30 and actually did the whole deal there and then. My question for you though is, what questions would you ask in the help visit? How would you structure that deal? And if you are thinking to yourself, well, I don't have enough information, I'll give you a few more bits of information in a moment, but this is how you do sophisticated deals. You're faced with a massive building. Now, to give you an idea, there are something like 4 bathrooms, 2 kitchens, and 12 habitable rooms. Something like 18 rooms for you to play around with if you subdivided them into normal size rooms. So the asking price of this property is £260,000. It had been sat on the market for quite a long time with a commercial agent at £260,000. So you're getting 18 rooms, the equivalent of 18 rooms, for £260,000. It's a brilliant deal if you can work out how to monetize it, if you can work out how to buy it quickly and then how to monetize it. Now, it's in a really rundown part of town. It's kind of on the outskirts of the town center in a not really very commercial area. That's probably why it suffered. There's a big car park opposite. They actually own a big shop opposite as well, and the car park's kind of shared between the two, this kitchen showroom and their big commercial building, and then there's this massive car park in between the two. Got a glass front, or a shop front, and it's in quite a residential area. It's kind of where the town centre turns into residential, and there's the odd shop, and then it's mostly residential. So it's just on that cusp of commercial and residential. And that's all there really was to it. It's in good condition. It's a bit worn inside and that, but it's in good condition. The roof was solid, the exterior was solid, there's no damp, etc. How would you structure it? What would you ask them? I'll leave you there. After the break, I will tell you how we did this particular deal.
This is the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast. To see more about our Sophisticated Saturdays, just search YouTube for Ethical Property Partners.
Welcome back. Hopefully you've actually had a go at structuring this deal. This is how we did it. So firstly, we offered a below market value purchase price. So it was the asking price of £260,000. I offered £198,000, which is roughly 25% below market value. Secondly, I offered to pay that, but only if they gave us a big chunk of the car park. And that was really important. We call it a buy one, get one free, because I knew that car park could become really valuable. We got about a third of the car park. It was a big car park, and I'll tell you why in a moment. We then went to two finance investors and brought them on board. It was actually two people from my church who were really interested in getting involved in the Stepping Stones project, and we decided that we were going to turn this commercial property into two residential dwellings. So we applied for planning permission for two houses. We got planning permission for those two houses, and then we operated both of them. We split those houses into two six-bed HMOs. So we now have 12 lettable rooms over two properties. We actually raised £260,000 from the finance investors. That enabled us to pay for the property, the 198, and purchase costs, etc., and do the title split the properties and turn them into compliant, licensable HMOs. We then leased those properties to a local charity. So we have one tenant who's paying HMO rates on all 12 bedrooms. So she's paying LHA rate for single occupancy on every single bedroom for a period of 3 years. That's the charity's lease. So we are basically getting zero voids, zero internal maintenance, and only one rental payment per month for the whole 3 years. It's a brilliant deal. And if we chose to, we could sell that property now for significantly more than the 198 that we paid for it, plus the cost of the works. In fact, that property now makes us about £1,500 a month, net profit after all costs, because the charity are responsible for all bills. So actually we make a really good profit from that property. Now, I did mention the car park opposite. Let me tell you about that. We applied for planning permission on that car park and got outline planning permission for six one-bedroom flats. We put that into auction. Now, what we did is we bought the property for £197,000, and we bought the car park for £1,000 with no lending on it. Now, the lending that we got on the property, the finance investors had charges on those, so they had security on those, but the land, the car park, was unencumbered. And what we did there is we got outline planning permission for six flats, we put it into an auction, the guide price was 60, 65 there or thereabouts, and we put it in with a very low reserve of around £20,000. Everyone got excited, people got their architects involved, people got their lawyers to check it out, people got their letting agents involved. It created a real stir in the auction. We made sure there was enough time for people to, you know, get their planning consultants involved as well, spend a bit of money on some fees, and then we had a lot of bidders, and it actually sold for £99,000. The piece of land that we'd paid £1,000 for sold for £99,000. And of course, now the property doesn't owe us £260,000. The property now owes us £160,000, but it makes £1,500 a month. That's a fantastic return, given that we haven't put any of our own money into the deal. Put no money in at all. In fact, we've had £99,000 out. If you came up with a solution similar to that, congratulations. If you didn't, have a think about what you missed. Did you miss the title split? Did you miss the finance investment? Did you miss the fact that we also financed the development? Did you miss the fact that we needed planning for two properties but then we didn't need planning to turn them into HMOs. If we'd applied for planning for a 12-bedroom HMO, it would have been turned down. But because we applied for two residential houses, so to split it into a semi-detached pair, that was fine. And of course, under permitted development, you can then turn those into HMOs.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for this second part of this Sophisticated Saturday episode, where Miss Pauline Chalmers, MFA for England and Wales, EPP England and Wales, is interviewing me about that deal that we've just described. So without further ado, I'll hand over to you, Pauline.
Thank you, Frank. That was a little bit formal, Miss Pauline Chalmers. Oh, very official. So it's a great deal. We can hear from what you said, it sounds like a great deal. How did you get to the offer that you made? Because the value that you said on the recording was it'd been on the market for 260,000 for quite a long period of time. So what drove the offer that you made of the 198,000?
What a good question. So I wasn't anticipating going down this route, but given that that's the question you've led with, it was the first time ever a vendor was in danger of being let down by EPP. And the way that that came about was we had a brand new franchisee who had delivered the leaflet and had asked me to mentor them on the help visit. So I'd gone to the help visit and had helped them to value the property 75%. So it was 260 down to 198. I think that's about 75% there or thereabouts.
It's just over, yeah.
Is it just over? Yeah, there might have been a few bits of work or something, but not a lot. And then the franchisee, I basically signed the deal up for the franchisee and said, you know, this is an awesome deal for you if you can finance it. Now, there wasn't the time to get commercial financing on this because of the old lady's health. And so before the help visit, I'd said, look, are you in a position to buy this? I knew the franchisee didn't have the cash and she had a family member that was going to lend her the entire 198 to purchase it. And then she was going to get development finance to split it. And I said, yeah, that's fine. We can make that work. So I did the entire negotiation on behalf of the franchisee, sorted it all out. And then a week later, she came back to me and said, actually, my family member's not willing to go ahead. They're worried about the risk. They don't think it's a good deal. And now I'm in a position where I've committed to buying this property from this vendor. The vendor's really excited, but I can't actually follow through. And I have to admit, I was quite disappointed. It's probably a bit of an understatement because I had stressed this over and over that this was absolutely critical. We don't make promises in EPP that we can't keep. Things don't always go to plan, but those are things outside of our control and we do our best to overcome them. We don't say one thing and then do another. It just doesn't sit within our culture and really conflicts with my values. And that was exactly what was happening. I don't even think it's a family member. I think it was a boyfriend. And so like, I'd really stressed, are you sure you're in this together? Yeah, we both want to invest, blah, blah, blah. So they wanted to walk away from it. They asked if they could walk away from it. And I said, well, if you're not able to buy it, then you'll have to. And they were about to drop the vendor in it and just say, sorry, we can't do what we said we'd do a week ago. And they just spent a week, you know, getting excited and getting their plans in order and, you know, getting the insurance.
Breathing a huge sigh of relief, I'd have thought, that they found a solution that they've been searching for quite a long
Absolutely.
Time.
I felt awful about it. And I said, look, before you phone them, let me see if I can raise the money. And so I made some calls and reached out to a few people. Funnily enough, it ended up being one person from my church and someone who'd got in touch from a different church, actually, about getting involved in the Stepping Stones project. And those became the two finance investors. So they weren't really people that had invested with me before. They weren't really people that were interested in property investment at all. One was really interested in Stepping Stones and housing the homeless, and the initial plan was that it was going to be Stepping Stones, then it was going to be a working sharers, so a blue collar HMO, and it ended up being a Stepping Stones property. And so they got their wish. You know, for the last few years they've helped to house 12 homeless people or 11 homeless people, because the charity's now taken one bedroom as an office every single night, and there's been a great throughput of young young homeless people through the property. The other people wanted to have their money doing some good work. You know, they wanted a social return, but also wanted a decent financial return. And they've had a 50 times, I think we're paying 5% interest. They've had a 50 times Bank of England base rate return for the last few years, which is pretty incredible, you know. So yeah, that's how it came about. The offer was really simple. It was 75% minus a few works. But the fact that I ended up buying it was not part of the plan. I just wasn't willing to let the vendor down, yeah.
And obviously time was of the essence from the vendor situation. And we recognise all the time that when we're making offers, vendors are motivated. And as you say, she'd been on the market for a long time and time was perhaps running out for her at that point in time. So well done for finding the finance investors and getting it over the line and honouring our franchisee's word around it. So it was sounds like it was commercial anyway. And it was already, was it already two separate houses, but they'd sort of merged it into one. So why didn't you go for a 12-bed HMO? Why did you go for, why go to the trouble of putting it into two 6-bed HMOs?
Yeah, so it had never been residential before. It hadn't ever been two houses. So it had been a commercial kitchen showroom on the ground floor, so very open plan, quite large windows, single door in the middle of the whole building. And the upstairs had been offices, so small office rooms, you know, small offices and filing rooms and a kitchen upstairs and stuff. And then it had some warehousing around the back and some small sheds, brick sheds and that, which actually still have development potential. We've actually worked out we can get two-bedroom houses and a one-bedroom bungalow around the back within the existing brick outbuildings. They're quite extensive. The rear building is actually two stories where we'll get two-bedroom semi-detached houses out of it. So that's a layer of icing for the future, actually, that I've not even touched.
That sounds like plan A for something.
It is, that absolutely is, and will be really valuable to us. There's a nice courtyard kind of connecting all the buildings together within the centre of the outbuilding. So the way I approach everything is I want to make money from every deal, cash flow now and profit in the future, but primarily cash flow now, with the minimum of investment. Because if you're coming at any transaction from a perspective of no money down, no money left in, infinite return, and those are all, you know, interchangeable, people are like all hung up on no money down. But if you get all your money out within a year, you can do an infinite number of deals, really, because these amazing deals don't grow on trees. You need to work pretty hard to find one a month, and are middle of the road performing franchisees who are doing 4, 5, 6 deals a year. They don't sit there, you know, flicking through Rightmove and have them drop into their lap. They're having to do marketing. They're having to go out and source them. So if you can get all your money back within a year, then you're going to be able to do lots of these deals. And so I started from the perspective of what can I do with this property from a commercial avenue. So how can I keep it in its current format, layout, and lease it? But the trouble is it's in a pretty deprived town, a bit far out from the business district. And so, if you think about a town, you generally have the A1, which is planning class for retail. So you've got your retail centre of a town. You might have some B1 office space. You probably get your A2 planning. Now all the planning classes are changing actually at the moment, but A2 are your estate agents, your bookmakers and solicitors' offices and stuff. They're normally a bit further off the high street. They're rarely, you know, plumb in the middle of the high street. Sometimes they are, but rarely. They're normally on a side street off the high street, if you think about your local towns, etc. Maybe with the exception of bookmakers. And then you've got your commercial, light industrial and residential, and those use classes have a lower density of usage and a lower land value, so they're further out from the centre. And this town, not only was the centre suffering and it was, you know, quite deprived, but this property is mile and a half from the centre. So it was definitely in that residential commercial kind of band of the town, if you want to call it that, not in the retail sector. And that's why it hadn't operated as kitchen showroom for so long. It was kind of a destination kitchen showroom where you'd park there, you'd go to it, and you'd, there were no other shops around it really. And so the problem with that as a commercial property is, who wants to rent it? There's no one shopping there. I couldn't think of a single commercial tenant class that would find that location attractive. And it was probably why it had been empty for so long, because there wasn't a demand for that kind of a property in that kind of area. So the idea of using it without doing much work to it and just letting it commercially didn't sit
stack up really.
Exactly. Yeah. It would have been such a long shot. Maybe it'd work, but I don't think so. Very, very slim odds. And I don't like slim odds, as you know. I'm quite risk averse. I want safe and steady, do a deal, let it out, forget about it, go do another deal. That's my method of running my portfolio. I don't want problem properties. And as a commercial let, it would have been a problem property. So I then looked at other uses. What could we turn it into? And residential was the obvious one, and HMOs even more so. So we could have applied for planning permission for a 12-bedroom HMO. The problem with that is it's next to a load of houses, and I wasn't confident we'd get planning. I spoke to my planning consultant, and he was really not keen on 12-bedroom HMO, the chances of us getting planning permission for that. And so we decided to split it into two houses, which we thought we'd easily get planning for. And in fact, we did get planning for that very easily, because it's surrounded by houses and a lot of them are semi-detached. And of course, this became a pair of semi-detached houses, you know, two houses attached. And so the great thing about having a house is that unless the permitted development rights have been withdrawn, which sometimes they are, for example, in an Article 4 area, your permitted development rights are restricted. In conservation areas, World Heritage sites, if the property's listed, there's quite a few reasons why the PD rights have been might have been removed. But if they haven't been removed, you can turn a house into a 6-bedroom HMO without asking anyone's permission. It's the same as putting, you know, a swimming pool in your back garden. You don't have to ask for planning permission for that, or a small shed, etc. So that's why we went down that route. So we applied for planning for two houses and then split each separate house into 6-bed HMOs. And although it's slightly more costly in terms of splitting the houses, soundproofing them, fireproofing them, it did actually help noise reduction. We probably needed the same number of bathrooms and kitchens anyway. And it made refinancing them a lot easier as well, because now we can refinance 2 6-bed HMOs, which are much easier, much cheaper to refinance than a 12-bed. So, and also, of course, we can sell one off and keep the other if we want to. We can let them as two separate HMOs. We could do one as a blue collar, one as a white collar. We've got quite a bit more flexibility. So
Flexibility.
That was the thinking behind it. And, you know, time, the great thing about doing these sophisticated Saturdays is sometimes we do a really recent deal and we just are able to describe how we've got it over the line. And sometimes we do one that's a few years old. And this is a decent number of years old now, this one. I think we're off the top of my head 4 years into this, something like that, which, you know, we've had a tenant we've only had one tenant. So for that whole time, we've had one tenant who took the first 6 rooms and then took the next 6 rooms and has said she wants to be in there long term, which, you know, that's the proof of the pudding is we've got next to no maintenance on this property at all, 100% occupancy over a number of years. I think that's the proof of the pudding, you know.
The good thing about having two separate houses, again, if the requirement from that charity diminishes, they can keep one of them, but you can use the other one as an HMO or a different charity, etc. Exactly. So you've got a bit more flexibility around it.
Exactly. It's a lot safer.
12-bed HMOs, it's not as flexible, is it?
Well, and also you've got 12 people trying to live together harmoniously. That's tough. Whereas 6 people living together with their own front door and their own kitchen, that's a lot easier. Not easy, but easier. That's why the charity have their work cut out, keeping everyone living harmoniously. Yeah.
Yeah. And the charity manage all that on this lease. They're responsible for what you talked about. They're responsible for the internal maintenance, except for the boiler as well as collecting all the rent, and then they make one rent payment to you under the terms of the lease. Is that right?
Correct. So they can collect rent or not. It's completely up to them. But they have a lease with us for, well, it's actually two leases, one for one property and one for the other property. So we get two payments a month on the same day. And actually, I think often they'll pay both in one payment, actually. So they're responsible for that. What they actually do is they sort out the, they do what's called an enhanced LHA application for their clients, because they help them with their washing. They help them to live as a household. They help them to go shopping together. It's a house for young people. And so they're helping them that have come out of care. So they're helping them to, you know, make the, well, it's a stepping stone, if we use that that word, to adulthood for them, and independence, having had everything done for them and perhaps been a little institutionalized in care. And so what they're able to do is pay us 100% of the LHA rate for young people, which is a sharer rate, and claim, I think, up to about 50%, maybe even 100% more on top to support that provision that they're providing to the young people above and beyond what a normal landlord would. So they pay us the landlord portion, and then they use the additional enhanced cap, is what it's called, enhancing the cap or raising the cap on the LHA payment, to provide that support to the young people. And if you think of it from a local authority perspective, it's such good value for money, because for as little as, I think the rate is £65 a week, something like that, per person. That's the LHA rate. So the local authority are paying that for the accommodation, and then they're paying something like that again for the support. Well, that's a lot of support for peanuts, really. You know, if that young person was in trouble with the law and in prison, then they'd be costing many times that, 10, 20, 30 times that a week, I would have thought. I'm not an expert on the cost of prison accommodation, but I imagine so. If they continue to be institutionalized and they're in a care home of some kind, or they were still in, you know, foster care, I imagine the cost would be much, much higher. So it's a, I think it's a win-win. It's good for the charity, it's good for the young people, it's a good deal for us, and it's good for the local authority. And that's what we strive to achieve in Stepping Stones on all our deals.
And you also talked about the investors as well, and them having an interest in that social aspect, providing finance for something that actually gives back to the community. And that's part of their passion. So it's providing them with, you know, a real feel good, isn't it? I can really hear how everyone wins in that.
Absolutely.
Great, actually, really great. You talked a little bit about the car park. So if we look at this, you initially talked about considering trying to minimise the work on the property as much as possible, the initial investment, because that's what we always do. We want our ROI to be as quick as possible, where we get our money out, where it didn't sound viable to keep it as a commercial unit because of where it was and the demand for it. And then you went to residential and assessed title splitting would work best. It would drive a lot more flexibility, and it would be easier to get planning and set it up as HMOs as well. So that's the second point. Then there's the added bit around the charity, not just you making a great return on it, but the charity benefiting, the tenants really getting a stepping stone to a new future, and your finance investors getting what they want, the social aspect of what they want. So what about the planning game then? So you talked about this little car park that you were able to include a portion of it in the purchase price. So what did you see for that? Did you see this up front, that this might be something that could be developed in the future?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when we go into any deal, we're always wanting plan A to break even or make money. It doesn't have to be a lot of money, but if it makes us cash flow each month or breaks even. One of my mentors used to have a saying, heads we win and tails we don't lose. And so if plan A covers all your potential risks, then you're laughing. And then you want plan B to improve the deal, to enhance it. And then plan C can enhance it even further, and plan D. And interesting, you said like plan F is to convert the two houses around the back and the bungalow around the back. That is probably plan F, because we've already done the title split. We've already done the Stepping Stones project and had the charity taken and internally repairing Lee's. And then one of the plans, plan C, plan D, was to get planning permission on the car park for flat and to sell that after achieving that planning gain.
It might be for people listening, you know, how do you do all of that? That's quite a complex transaction to kind of hang it all together. So, and obviously you've got a lot of experience, Frank, in doing that. So how can someone who's listening, how are they able to do that?
Do you know, you're absolutely right. It's a very insightful question. Novice investors, and I think this comes back to psychology, I think it's because deep in their psyche, they don't think they're worthy of doing these great deals. Deep down, they self-sabotage. Deep down, they can't make $100,000 on a deal without doing any work or with doing, you know, a few hours work. And they'll find a way of self-sabotaging. So if you think about this, this wasn't my deal. This was the franchisee's deal. They talked themselves out of it. They allowed their boyfriend or family member, whoever it was, to talk them out of it. They missed out. You know, if they're listening to this podcast, they're no longer a franchisee. They've graduated and moved on. But if they listen to this podcast, they'll probably feel really disappointed. But it was theirs to take. It was their deal. And they bottled it, for want of a better phrase. I've just come off the golf course and I was playing on my own. I love playing on my own, and I'm a bit of a loner. I actually had a 2-hour phone call with my dad. Actually, he lives in Bulgaria, the whole way around the course. It was lovely. And there was a four ball, so four people playing in front of me, and I teed off behind them on the first tee, and on the second tee they teed off and then waited on the fairway, waited to the side and said, "You play through." And it was so funny. On the first hole, there's no one around me, did a beautiful 200-yard tee shot, which is good for me. I chipped it onto the green. I was really relaxed, chatting to my dad, playing well. Then I got on the second tee and there's these four people watching me. And I said to my dad, "I'm just going to hang up, Dad. Give me 10, 15 minutes because I've got to just like play through, and it'll look really rude if I'm chatting on the phone while they're all waiting for me." And lo and behold, tensed up.
You were rubbish.
I was. I absolutely was. I tensed up and I knocked it. So first hole, 200 yards, dead straight, lovely. I nearly hit one of the golfers who stood to the side. Fortunately, like, they were watching for me, and I hit it about 45 yards. And like my head went down. I was like, "Oh, so now I've got to go and hit it in front of this golfer who I've nearly just hit." And the hole was a complete disaster. But what had changed? I hadn't suddenly become a rubbish golfer. Psychologically, I couldn't cope with that pressure. Psychologically, I wasn't good enough. I wasn't experienced enough to perform in that new arena. And that's the difference. Like, I played through it as a bit of a disaster hole. Funnily enough, once I'd hit it 100 yards beyond them all, I was relaxed again. And actually, I finished the hole okay. But then the third hole, I was back to my normal self and hitting it smoothly and playing great. And that's the thing. If you are used to playing the game of property investing at a certain level, when you get a deal that's especially good, you suddenly freeze, you suddenly get a bit tense. And it can be, "Oh, I can't get funding, so I need to back out." Or it can be oversharing with the vendor. "So I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this." And they don't need to know all that. They just want to know they're getting $198,000 in the next few weeks. You don't have to. And then people will go, "Well, I'll do it subject to planning." That's how a lot of novice investors would have stuffed this up. "I'll buy the house or the commercial premises and the car park, but only if I can get planning on the commercial premises and planning on the car park." Well, I think it took us 3.5-4 months to get planning on the car park. The vendor wouldn't have waited for that.
No.
And then the novice investor would go, "Wow, it's a bit of a risk though. What if I don't get planning on the car park?" Really? It's £1,000 punt with perhaps $100,000 upside. Why do you need planning on that? You don't need planning at all. It's £1,000 punt. And if you do five of them, you'll get, you know, on different deals, you'll get one of them through. So just like play the averages. And then, and I've had this criticism leveled at me previously, what if you didn't get residential planning on the commercial to turn it into two houses? Yeah, there's a possibility. but you have to back yourself. You know, like the equivalent would be to say, no, no, guys, you four carry on. I'll just play really slowly behind you for the next 17 holes. You know, I'll just have it take 5 hours rather than 4 hours because I don't have the confidence to play through. That's the equivalent. And it happens. I see people bottle it. I'm in a mastermind. One of my friends, a guy called Paul Mort, some of the listeners might know him. If not, you can Google him. He has just sold out a 1,000-person theatre for his first of his speaker tour event that he's doing at the moment. He's just been signed by HarperCollins for a book deal. 2 years ago, when we first met and started supporting one another in this mastermind, he was speaking to 30 people in a room. He was self-publishing his own book and selling it from his own website. It wasn't even on Amazon. He has grown to a level where he can play through four players and not even flinch. That's where he's at. I'm not at that level in golf, but he's at that level in business. Another friend of mine, who I shan't name, when COVID came around, stopped his business. Complete, we're talking about a seven-figure business. Well, high six, low seven-figure business. Stopped it and said, I'm just going to ride it out. Well, COVID went on for quite a long time. Arguably, it's still going on now. And so, you know, for me, that's the equivalent of knocking it 30 yards and then, you know, knocking it 10 yards and then knocking it 25 and like snapping your club on your knee and having a complete meltdown. And you sometimes see that on the PGA Tour. You get the results you deserve. And Paul deserves to have a sold out theatre with 1,000 people. I was over the moon for him because he's now playing at that level. And so for me, novice investors will often do too much. They'll try and make it too good a deal. If it's got zero risk and is going to make you tons and tons of money, everyone else is going to do it, or the vendor's going to get greedy, or it's going to take too long. So there has to be a confidence in you that you can do this, that yes, there's going to be some unforeseen stuff, but you can make it work. And so I spoke to my architect. I said, look, I've got this beautiful bit of land. I reckon we can get some flats. How many? I didn't know how many. I didn't know what the value of the land would be after I'd got planning, but I knew it'd be better than £1,000, and I knew there was a good enough chance. Even if I only got one house on it, it's worth probably 15 grand in that area. Well, £1,000 for a piece of land, sell it for 15, that wouldn't be the end of the world. So that's how I approach this, Pauline. We talk about layers of icing. The deal has to work, and then you add the layers of icing. But it doesn't happen overnight. I think it took us, I forget exactly, but 18 months to get the planning and sell that piece of land, maybe even 2 years. But I wasn't in a hurry. Probably could have banged it through quicker, but I had other deals on the go. You know, I was more interested in getting the development finished and getting it let out. That was the main priority. If you do enough of these deals, statistically, loads of them will work and you'll get plan A, B, or layer of icing B, C, D, and E. And some of them you won't. And that's okay, because overall you make a killing on the ones that you get the layers of icing, and on the ones you don't, they just wash their face, you know, and you go, oh, it's not been as good as it could have been, but still makes me 50 quid a month, 100 quid a month, and those all add up. So it's about being okay with it. Yeah. And I think it's funny, isn't it? I've never expected to talk about golf today so much, but I think it's the equivalent of just being relaxed. When you're relaxed and you're hitting the ball, you hit it beautifully. When you're like, oh, this I can win on this. I can get under my handicap if I just chip this on the green. And then you go and hit the ground 6 inches before it. And it's like, oh, well, that's not a coincidence. That's because you choked, you know. So I think if you can stay really relaxed and in a position of abundance when negotiating these deals, when actually doing the deals and doing the developments and communicating with your team, I think you're far more likely to A, enjoy the journey, and B, make more money, ironically. Thanks for the questions, Pauline. Hopefully those are the questions that our audience were thinking about.
No problem, my pleasure.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us for this Sophisticated Saturday episode. Until next time, happy investing.
That was the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast from Ethical Property Partners. Use your podcast app to follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.